Hello. If you are new here, welcome. If you are a returning guest, returning listener, I promised you that regular programming would come back, and here it is. This is an interview with Grace Yee. Grace put out a book middle of last year with Giramondo called Chinese Fish. It's a book about... It's basically about a group of Chinese settlers living in Aotearoa, New Zealand, and it's told in a very interesting, very different way than what you would expect. It kind of weaves together multiple characters, multiple voices, and a whole bunch of archival material. There's a lot of research that's gone into the book. The Giramondo press release says it offers a glimpse into the lives of women and girls in a community that has historically been characterized as both a yellow peril menace and an exotic model minority. The book that it is most like is probably Jess Wilkinson's Marionette, her poetic biography of Marion Davies. Jess's work feels very closely related to Grace's work, although I'm not sure that they have any professional connection at all. But it's that same strategy of bringing in every piece of material that you can find, knitting it together to tell a story in a way that's really rich and really true and pretty complicated. So 2 weeks before Grace came around to talk to me, she had just won the Victorian Premier's Literary Awards, both the prize for literature overall and the prize for poetry with this book. And as you can hear when we start out, this was a pretty overwhelming thing to happen. Grace's responses are responses that I very much relate to, not that I've ever had anything like that kind of recognition, but I immediately understood what she was describing, and I want to talk a little bit more about that when I come back at the end. For now, though, I did just want to say Grace mentioned that she sometimes recommends this show to her students. If you're one of Grace's students, welcome. I'm sorry. I hope you're getting something out of the show. If you want to know, if you want some tips about where to start, I would say go start with the Forbes episodes and then do the Porter episodes. And then I think from there, if you're bought in at that point, you can kind of go anywhere. And if you don't like it, you don't like it. That's cool. I can't get you any extra marks or credit, unfortunately. Here is Grace. I was wondering if we could start with you telling us a little bit about the Victorian Premier's Literary Awards and what that was like.
What happened, goodness.
And what it was like.
It was quite overwhelming, as you can imagine. And in the aftermath, when I was doing the media with the publicity people from the Wheeler Centre, and we went out for coffee because we were between interviews, and they were like, did you have any idea?
Did you?
Did you know? And I said, no, absolutely not. Because I had to do three interviews with newspapers the day before.
Okay.
Well, just... actually two the day before and one the morning of. It was The Age, ABC Arts and The Guardian. And when the Wheeler Centre rang me to arrange those, they said that they wanted to interview all the category winners. So when I got there, there were a few of the other category winners. There was Melissa Lukashenko, Alan Van Nieuwen, and I think it was Daniel Browning who won the Indigenous Prize, I think. Anyway, I took one look at them and I thought, it's got to be Melissa or Ellen, right? So that was that. So yeah, so when it was announced, it was quite a shock.
Yeah. How do you feel now?
I'm accepting it now.
You were in some denial at the start?
I kept saying to my friend Alison Wong, who was with me on the night, is this real? You know, pinch me. It just doesn't feel real. And even the next day when I was at ABC Studios, you know, doing all the interviews there, and I said to the marketing people at the Wheeler Centre, it was Kate and Caroline, I said, I still feel like I'm going to wake up tomorrow and have to get ready for the award ceremony. It's just so bizarre, and I was so tired. And I thought, oh, I must be still sleeping, you know.
I've been having this conversation with a friend of mine about whether imposter syndrome is a real thing. Do you feel like
that? I feel like that all the time.
Can you expand on that? What specifically?
I think I might have said in one of my newspaper interviews, maybe, and it's been quoted since a few places I've noticed with Sian Kane, where I said I thought, you know, because I was quite overwhelmed to win the poetry prize to start with, right? And when I was going off getting ready for the award ceremony, I was still quite overwhelmed about that and a bit stressed about that. But I said to her, and she said, are you surprised that, you know, and I said, well, yes. I said, because this feels like, you know, such a marginal kind of little story, and to have this acknowledgement it was astonishing.
Marginal.
Yeah, well, the story is marginal. It's about marginal people. I mean, you know,
right.
And but I still feel like, you know, it's such a little story. It's not like in the center of Australian life or anything like that. I mean, it's a New Zealand story as well.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
I read your interview with Liminal magazine, and in that you said that you'd been contacted by people from a lot of different diaspora communities who'd said that they related to it, though. So maybe
it's not as
marginal.
It was quite a surprise and very, very heartwarming
yeah.
to have that feedback
yeah.
and not something I anticipated at all.
Do you? So the book was awarded for poetry and literature overall. Do you see it as squarely in the poetry category?
I feel like it's very much a hybrid work.
Mm-hmm.
Not just in terms of genre, you know, because I'm a real history buff, so I've interwoven all that. I did a hell of a lot of historical research, and there might not be that much on the surface in the book, mm-hmm. but underpinning it was a hell of a lot of historical research. So I see it as a kind of verse novel. I see it as kind of straddling poetry and fiction, but also as a hybrid poetry, fiction, history thing.
Yeah. Well, I certainly learned some stunning facts about it, particularly about New Zealand's immigration laws and Australia's as well. I was wondering if I could get you to read a tiny section of it.
Yeah, sure.
I picked out this bit for a number of different reasons, but it does mention some of the truly draconian, I suppose is one word you could use to describe them, immigration laws that Australia had in the early 70s. So just that page there.
Yes, okay. So do you want a little bit of context?
That'd be lovely, yeah, thank you.
So this poem is in the chapter titled, is it Paradise? No, Good Luck and Plenty. Good Luck and Plenty. And in this scene, Ping, who's the protagonist, is over at her neighbour Angie's place with the kids. Angie's living room. The little one sprawled on the floor watching Bewitched on TV. Ping perched on the sofa, piled high with sheets and towels and souvenirs from Australia. We had such a good time, didn't we, kids? How'd you like this, Ping? Angie, nose twitching like Samantha's, clutching a curly-haired doll with blue eyes that opened shut, skirt made of shells. Found her at the market. Geez, they had good stuff there. Look at these. Tea towels printed with maps of Australia, boomerangs and kangaroos, dotted circles on their flanks. Which ones do you want? Ping smiles, shakes her head. Up until December 1972, Chinese New Zealanders were only eligible for 72-hour visas when visiting Australia. Other New Zealanders were granted 3-month visas. These will look good in your kitchen. And here's some wee koalas for the kids. This This is the best. Look, you screw it in the wall, put your loo paper here, tunes into all the stations. Angie turns the dial and Neil Diamond is singing. So everybody wants one. I mean, that's a reference to Song Sung Blue.
I love Neil Diamond so much. My mum used to play Neil Diamond when she was particularly sad. 72-hour visas. You also talk about the immigration laws to New Zealand as well.
Yes.
Yeah. Can you talk a bit about that, the limits that were placed on people?
There were so many.
Yeah.
In my PhD thesis, I did a lot of research into that and actually drew up, I think it was 3 or 4 pages worth of legislation. So there was a lot there. I think it started in 1881. There was poll tax, and then the poll tax got increased. And then there were all sorts of really, really strict quotas for women because they didn't want the woman over because they didn't want us breeding. So that was right up until very strict regulations excluding the Chinese population right up until 1987.
So the whole book is that sort of polyvocal approach. Even in that one poem, there are multiple people speaking, and then the historical fact breaks in midway. And so that's the approach that you've taken.
Yeah, when I was writing it, I had no idea I'd be doing so many readings.
Right, of course, because you've got to do that. You've got to play all these characters.
I did not anticipate this.
Yeah, good point. Yeah, okay. I wanted to ask about, in your notes that you sent through to me that were in preparation for a panel discussion with Nadia Nayez, what stood out to me was you mentioned responsibility. And I'm imagining the moment the night before the book is launched, because it's one thing to write a book like this and have it as, it's always a private thing, you know, like it's not real. And then there's that night before the launch where suddenly, I know this happened for me in a much more minor way, suddenly it feels like, oh, this is actually going to be, people are going to read this.
And they're going to read things into it.
That's kind of what I wanted to ask you about. I had a conversation with Alison Whittaker a couple of years ago now, maybe 3 years ago, where she talked about her anthology that she put together, Firefront. And what she did with that, which is a collection of Indigenous writing, what Alison did was she got Indigenous elders to write essays at the start of each section. And she told me she did that so she could shield the work from misinterpretation. Which I thought was, I'd never thought about it before, like just in my sort of dumb, sort of bumbling white way, I was just like, oh, well, you know, surely no, everybody gets it. Everybody, you know, gets the same thing from a book, but of course that's not the case.
No.
So what thoughts do you have about that now that the book is out in the world?
I don't think about it too much.
probably sensible.
Responsibility. Do you mean responsibility in terms of how it would be construed in my own community or just more broadly?
Do either bother you or do you just kind of set that aside and
think? I have set it aside.
Yeah.
Because you know what? It's this whole thing about worrying what other people think. I mean, if we as writers do that, we'll never write anything. There's always going to be people who don't like what you write. In terms of shielding, I think that's a really good point, because I thought of that in a sense when I did the translations and the glossary, even for Cantonese speakers, because it's not straight Cantonese, it's not pure Cantonese. In fact, none of it's pure at all. You know, it's a mix of Cantonese and Taishanese, which is Hui Sanhua, and it's a hybrid. And that is the language that we grew up with, and it's still there, you know, and mixed in with the broken English and everything. In fact, all those languages in there which the characters speak are all broken. So it was really important to me to have those translations and the explanations at the back of the book.
So you also mentioned this question of the characters and the glossary in your notes for that conversation with Nadia. And you were talking about how a glossary could be like a protective or preemptive measure as well. It shows people that there's a different kind of language being spoken there. It's its own dialect. It's its own idiom, it sounds
yeah,
like.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. Because I have read reviews in the past of other writers' work where they've incorporated other languages, and they have been critiqued for quite harshly for not using that other language in, you know, purely, mm-hmm. or, you know, in its pure form, or they're criticizing it and saying it doesn't make any sense, etc., etc. And
it's funny, isn't it? Because it's kind of like the expectation for the non-English languages that it be perfect, but if the English is a little bit slapdash or, you know, using colloquialisms, then that's fine.
Yeah.
It's weird.
Yeah, so I was preempting that, and I still think that was necessary to have those translations.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you want to talk about the title in relation to that? Because there's quite an interesting, funny story about why it's called Chinese Fish.
Well, I decided on Chinese Fish quite early on. I ran through a few other titles, but they're awful. And then I landed on Chinese Fish, and it so happened that it's the middle sequence of, you know, seven sequences, and it's the middle one. Oh, no, that's perfect. Mm. And the story behind it was because I'd found one of the found poems, which is the first poem in that Chinese Fish section. Shall I read it?
Yeah, that'd be great.
It's very short, yep. Isn't it?
Thank you.
Chinese food is supposed to be good, but it is strange and uncanny. In a bowl of clean water, there were several things that looked like the specimens that are kept in spirits and surgeons' museums. Fish, explained the cook. What sort? Oh, Chinese fish. So that's a found poem that was part of a very long news story written in 1904, written by this journalist who was accompanying a health inspector in Wellington's Chinatown. And so they'd gone into this, they called them cook shops back then, mm-hmm. and this is what they found, you know, they're looking around and aghast at what they perceived to be filth and odd things lying around in bowls. And so that was that little encounter. And I see the title, it can be quite ambiguous, and that's what I liked about it. So Chinese fish, you know, like as a noun phrase, is, well, it just sounds exotic, doesn't it? And but in that encounter with the Chinese cook says to the inspector, oh, Chinese fish, you know, that's his answer. That's a deflection. It's like, you know, you don't need to know. I'm just telling you, it's Chinese fish. And it shut the conversation down.
Yeah, in saying that, he knows that the health inspector will just kind of roll his eyes and walk away.
Like, yeah.
It's something I'll never understand.
Exactly, exactly. Yeah. The fish is inscrutable.
Yeah.
So that to me was a kind of a, like a synecdoche for all the different kinds of tactics, I guess, for the Chinese community at that time, but also over subsequent generations, of coping with these kinds of interrogations. Oh, you know, just say it's Chinese. They'll accept that, you know?
Yeah, yeah. They'll leave you alone. Yeah.
Or variations thereof.
Right. So in that interview with Liminal, you gave some advice to other diaspora writers, which I thought was really, really fantastic, and I wanted to dig into with you. You're talking to writers who are creating a work similar to Chinese Fish, and I'm going to quote a big chunk of your advice back at you, if you don't mind. You said, keep your good friends close and discuss the project only with those who you know are on the same page. Resist the urge to talk people around. That depletes energy better channeled into the book. And then you went on to say that the very early poems for Chinese Fish were fake and fawny because they were narrated in what I believe to be a palatable voice, but that palatability compromised the story's emotional truths. I thought that there's such excellent advice in that, because yeah, you would deplete a lot of energy talking to poets who don't quite know what you are up to.
Yeah. Well, not even just poets, just people who, you know, interested in what you might be writing, you know. It's like, you know, you don't have the energy to have those kinds of discussions. go and do your own reading.
Yeah. I often get asked, like, what kind of poetry do you write? Or, like, what do you write about? The last time somebody asked me that, I said, I write poems for revenge. that she didn't ask me any more questions after. So in bringing up that advice to other diaspora writers, I'm thinking also about an interview I did with a writer called Mindy Gill.
Ah, yes.
And Mindy spoke really eloquently about the pressure on non-white writers to tell a particular kind of story. And one of the things that she highlighted that I think is so true is that pressure to publish before they're truly ready. And then when I interviewed Pio, he went off on a rant about this, and he parodied the voice of a white academic. And he was saying, you know, they would say something like, you look like a migrant. You write like a migrant. Oh, you know, you should write like a migrant. And I'm thinking about all that, and thinking particularly about your comment about the early drafts being fake and fawny. If you had been 10 years younger writing this is your debut collection.
Yeah.
What would, and you were under pressure, what would the book have been like, do you think?
I dread to think. And that's part of the reason why it's come out now. You know, later in life, as they say. But also, I couldn't have written it any earlier because I was too busy raising kids, etc., etc. But I'm so happy that it's come out now, because I hate to think what kind of a book would have been the first book in a very different voice. And I think I would have looked back and cringed at it.
Yeah, and I guess we all cringe at our first collections to, you know, greater and lesser degrees, but...
I cringe at earlier poems that have been published, right. Yes.
Yeah, right.
But, you know, I feel like, okay, the title, I mean, Chinese Fish and the topic and everything, you know, at first glance, it looks like it's a book that people might expect from someone of a migrant background, right? And I guess in many ways it is, but, you know, for people who've read the book, you know, I think most people, when they read the book, they realize that it's more than that, and it's actually talking back to that very expectation. You know, it's flipping it in so many places.
Yeah, and with the approach of using a mix of voices and also found material and also and the historical research that you've done, I was reminded very much of Jess Wilkinson's work and poetic biography that she's done, you know, just building up a picture through multiple sources and then creating something that is like so rich and so true, because it's including kind of everything. Going back to the advice to other diaspora writers, is there anything else that you would add to that? Resisting the urge to talk people around and sort of keeping the project pretty like contained?
I think there was something else, wasn't there? Did I say something about experimenting with voices?
Yes.
You know, to get around the internalized racism, which is, you know, the reason for the fake and fawny voice in the first place. That's really important. This is why I have so many different voices. It wasn't so much indecision about, you know, which voice to use. I felt very strongly that I needed all of the voices.
Yeah. So the book, by my very rough count, has been reviewed about 7 times at this stage. Does that sound
right? Yeah, that sounds right. Yep.
And that was sort of last year, 2023. I did a big episode recently where I kind of went through the number of reviews that had been put out over a calendar year. And so I now understand that 7 reviews for a book is quite a few. Like, it's a pretty big chunk for any Australian collection of poetry.
Yeah, it hasn't even been a year yet. So, yeah.
Yeah.
Strangely, though, it hasn't been reviewed in Aotearoa.
Really?
No.
What's happening over there?
I don't know.
What are they up to? They're just taking their time, perhaps. I wondered if there had been, and there's no need to go into specifics, feel free to talk in as general terms as you like, but were there instances where you felt like things had been missed or misinterpreted in the reviews?
Not really. Everyone has a different take on it. I mean, I get that, and everyone reading it is coming from a different place, and I've really enjoyed reading all the reviews, regardless of whether I agree or disagree with them, because it gives me a different perspective on my work. And I learn so much from the reviews. I guess it would be great to have a review that digs more into the craft.
Right. Yeah, we don't seem to do that very much. That seems to be missing in a broad sense.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. From a poet's perspective, to me that's fascinating to read about craft. Mm. There's been, the reviews have tended to focus on, you know, the broader themes and all of that.
Mm.
And yeah.
Would you like to talk a bit about the choices that you made in terms of the craft? I mean, there are a lot of decisions on every single page.
Oh, goodness, yes. Yeah. I could talk a little bit about it.
Yeah. I don't know how to sort of sum things up, if you can sum things up generally, but yeah.
Yeah, well, I could talk about how I formatted the voices.
Great.
Perhaps. I have multiple narrators and I wanted to make that clear on the page. So there's Ping, who's the protagonist, and her daughter Cherry. Ping's voice is set in very narrow columns, and which reflects the way that settler Chinese women in Aotearoa saw themselves as marginal, saw themselves as small, and they had a reputation for many generations of being like self-minimizing. So those narrow columns reflect that. It's a little like, am I allowed to speak, you know? And her voice is italicized to reflect the fact that that it's so significant that she gets to speak at all. Cherry's voice, she has her own lyric poems, which are kind of like a bridge, you know, between the Chinese family and the outside world, because, you know, most people think of poems as lyric poems. And she also inserts, her voice is also inserted within what I think of as the omniscient narrator, in little asides and brackets, which are kind of quite well padded on either side with spaces as a protective thing, like, oh, you can have your little say in here and we'll protect you, you can say it in here. And the Orientalist narrator, which is flush right on each page, I put him there, and I do think of him as a him. I put him there because it's such a self-righteous voice.
Can I read the one that I had dog-eared of that nature? This is from the first section. The Chinese, they come from China, came by boat. Tough lives over there, what with the opium, the Japanese, Chairman Mao. Here they stick together in their laundries and fruit shops and restaurants. They work hard, seem happy enough, lucky to be here. The number of times I've heard that phrase, lucky to be here.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I had a lot of fun with that Orientalist voice. Most of those poems in that voice were created from extracts from the archives, and quite a lot of it wasn't even changed apart from the line breaks.
So I asked about reviews. This is sort of it's a question that could go either way, depending on how things have been going. But I wonder if there are aspects of the book that people like myself, interviewers, haven't asked you about, or that reviewers haven't mentioned. We talked about craft a bit, that you'd really like to highlight.
I don't know. I think I just want to say, though, that, you know, in the year leading up to when the book came out, and especially the last, say, 3 months before it got sent off to the printers, that was incredibly intense, going through the manuscript. I was tracking, you know, all the different narrative threads, and in my mind, you know, the timeline and all of that, and it was incredibly hard work. And at one point, someone said, "Oh, why don't you put some dates in there, you know?" And I said, "Well, there's a date at the beginning, and there's you know, the period, the 60s to the 80s in the blurb, and it's marked throughout with key events, which have dates if anyone wants to look them up." So I didn't feel the need to be putting in specific dates. I'm wondering also, can I ask you, as a reader, whether you found that disorienting?
Not at all. No, not at all. But this is the kind of book that I'm really comfortable with. Like, I think Jess trained me well. Like, I kind of, I feel totally at home with a book that is going to use like a lot of found text. I loved, you know, like I said, having a bit of fun trying to figure out the characters on my own before I flipped to the glossary. I wasn't too concerned with, like, even really holding on to the narrative thread that tightly, because I knew we were going to jump around. And I knew that by the time I got to the end, I was going to have a really rich and full picture of this family's life, which I absolutely did. But I also learned some, like, totally shocking facts about what it was like to be, you know, to live in this migrant community. This is going to sound so dumb, but, like, I have this idea of New Zealand as, like, this kind of
paradise.
Yeah, like a full-on, like, I don't know. I went through Auckland on the way home from
the
US.
But Auckland's not New Zealand.
I know. Well, okay,
it's like
fair
saying
enough.
LA is America.
Fair enough. That's fair. But I have a very silly kind of, like, idea of it as a multicultural promised land.
People have the same idea about Australia.
Oh, Jesus. Yeah. So I learned a great deal about what that was really like. And it didn't bother me at all that I didn't have, like, specific dates, times and places. But I'm not a particularly specific person either. Like,
I think most artists aren't.
Yeah, I'm pretty all over the shop, yeah. Just as a final question, so you were talking before about the amount of work that went into that final proof, and you were saying just before we started that you're actually in those final stages with the next book as well. How is that feeling?
I haven't seen the proofs yet, so I can let you know when I see the proofs.
Okay. It's so nerve-wracking, isn't it, when you get those back and you're just like, oh my God.
There's still so much work to do.
Yeah. And every time you change it, it's like...
Yeah,
it's nerve-wracking.
It really is. I was pulling all-nighters probably in the last month or so leading up to the final, you know, proof.
Yeah.
But they were so great at Jeremondo. They were so great and so patient.
Yep, I hear that word from a lot of people, actually, in relation to that team, so that's really good to hear.
Yeah, they're amazing.
I do have a little cricket friend outside. I hope he's not too annoying. I had a cricket in the office once and I felt that it really added to things. I wanted to come back to basically the imposter syndrome question that came up at the start of this episode. And I'm going to quote from The Yellow Notebook. Helen Garner Diaries, Volume 1, 78 to 87. I know it's not the hottest take to be a 41-year-old woman writer who's very, very into the Helen Garner Diaries. But I am. That's what this is. I can't pretend otherwise. These are basically my Bible. And I want to read this one little bit, which is going to take me a minute to find, because it specifically addresses this exact feeling. Okay, that took like 10 minutes, but while I was looking for it, I found at least three other bits that I want to read out. So this is from 1978, so she's about 36. Yeah, 36. She's talking about her novel Monkey Grip. Monkey Grip appears to have won the National Book Council Award. Letter from T in Melbourne. Sometimes I fall into the trap of thinking that jobs and money and grants are luck instead of recognition for talent and hard work. Do you feel that still? Skip forward to 1983. So now she's my age, 41. This is one of the shortest entries in the diary, but it's one of my favourites. I can't write anymore. I'm clumsy. Outside my window, a fine rain is falling, perfectly vertical. Skip forward another year. Oh, frustration and despair. And last week I thought I was getting somewhere. I'm just a middle-level craftswoman. Saw a doco on TV about James Joyce, his vast reading, his intellect, his disorderliness, etc., etc. Pooh, pooh, I cry. Then the voiceover reads a paragraph from The Dead, and I'm gasping with tears in my eyes. And then the next entry is, I feel, when it goes badly, resentful and alarmed at the thought that I must spend the rest of my working life in this discomfort, inadequacy, and grief. Grief is not too strong a word for what one feels before one's own weakness and mediocrity. And the next year, 1985, I have read in feminist literature about women who could not handle their own talent, who were ashamed of it, or tried to hide it. I never thought I would become one of those. But one comes under certain subtle pressures that are unforeseeable in their form, direction, and detail. I guess I just wanted to bring all that in here at the end, because the thing that Grace is talking about at the start, that feeling of this must be a dream, this can't actually be real, this isn't really happening to me, my book is, my story is too small, my story is marginal. I mean, I guess Helen Garner in the Yellow Notebook, she's kind of gradually mounting an argument that this is a female thing. I don't know that it has to be. It definitely seems to be a writerly thing. It definitely seems to come with the territory. And that's why I love the diaries, because it's like with every third or fourth entry, you get to see what it was like for one of the masters, one of the greats. I have an episode coming up on Slee Ricketts in some amount of time where we dig into this question of imposter syndrome pretty specifically in quite a bit of detail. And I think it will be a good one. I think you'll enjoy that. Last thing to say here, I haven't really prepared any notes about this, but I did want to just say hi and thank you and express my appreciation for everybody who wrote in after listening to the episode I called Antarctica. I guess I am realizing with the correspondence that I've been receiving that there were still a lot of things that I had imagined that just weren't real. One of those things being that parents have a sense of certainty. Like once you become a parent, you know exactly what your choice meant and you feel completely confident in it. You know, it sounds so obvious, but it's not often that I really get to hear from parents who say, like, Yeah, there's not that certainty. And even when I had had my first child, I didn't really know about the second, and I went straight back to the place that you're describing. I also heard from people who went through this agony, I guess I'll say, about a decade before I did, and that felt like a bit of a wake-up call, I suppose. You know, I'm still old enough to remember when Julia Gillard was referred to as deliberately barren. But, you know, the expectations that were placed on me were a little bit more flexible, I think. I know they were more flexible than would have been placed on women even 10 years older than me. So it's complicated my thinking in some ways, but also putting that out there has given me a great deal of peace, honestly, just because I just feel so much more known. Like, that story is kind of like everything I could possibly tell you in some ways. There's like details and like side quests that I went on, dead end side quests. But that's the one big story. And so having shared that with you, I feel a bit more known and connected and yeah, like surprised at the level of understanding that's out there. Okay, well, it's still extremely hot. I was going to record something about Susan Sontag, but I think my brain is not going to cope with that tonight, so that might have to happen tomorrow morning. Thanks for listening.